From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The war in Afghanistan has proved dangerous for journalists to cover. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two journalists who've just returned. Sebastian Younger, author of Fire and the Perfect Storm, was with the 1st Northern Alliance tanks to enter Kabul when the city fell. Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe was in Mazar-e-Sharif during the uprising of Taliban prisoners who had surrendered to the Northern Alliance. He watched the Northern Alliance and U.S. forces put down the rebellion. We'll also talk with Sennett about how the equation in the Middle East has changed over the past few days. He's the Boston Globe's former Middle East bureau chief. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pentagon officials say U.S. Special Forces are now working with Afghan militia groups in the Tora Bora region, where Osama bin Laden is believed to be hiding. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The Tora Bora region is remote and mountainous, barely accessible from outside. During their war against the Soviet Army, Afghan resistance fighters enlarged and connected a number of natural mountain caves there, and it is in those caves that bin Laden and his al-Qaeda followers have apparently taken refuge. 1,000 or more militia forces have launched a massive manhunt. Marine General Peter Pace, Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, says U.S. Special Forces are helping.
As the opposition groups move their troops through that complex, we're able to provide them the air support that they can help direct because they are able to see the caves that are active, they can see the caves that are not.
The U.S. airstrikes on the Tora Bora caves are intense and apparently taking a toll. Local commanders say dozens of al-Qaeda fighters have been killed there so far. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
The U.N. Security Council today gave a unanimous show of support for the new temporary government of Afghanistan. The agreement envisions a 2.5-year transition to a post-Taliban government in the country. The council did not address the issue of an international security force for the Afghan capital, Kabul. Attorney General John Ashcroft faced a surprisingly reserved Senate committee today as he defended the administration's stance on military tribunals and civil liberties in the age of terrorism. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
For several hours, John Ashcroft took the offensive with his former colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said people who raise fears of lost liberties are only aiding the terrorists. He said charges at a military tribunal would be a kangaroo court, quote, give new meaning to the term fog of war.
Each action taken by the Department of Justice, as well as the war crimes commissions considered by the President and the Department of Defense, is carefully drawn to target a narrow class of individuals, terrorists.
Ashcroft said he would not always consult with Congress about military tribunals. That's been a sore point for lawmakers. He added that the president can establish military tribunals without congressional approval. Many in Congress, as well as the public, support military tribunals. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Government officials say the anthrax-tainted letter sent to Senator Patrick Leahy is identical to the letter sent to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. Scientists at the Army's Biodefense Laboratory in Maryland opened the Leahy letter yesterday. The officials say the wording of the two is identical. The FBI hopes the tests on the envelope and its contents will help track down the sender. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 15 points to 10,099. The Nasdaq was up 7 at 2054. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. At least 2 people are dead and up to 6 people are injured after a gunman in Goshen, Indiana, opened fire in a manufacturing plant. Marianne Holland of member station WVPE is on the scene.
A gunman at the Newwood Decorative Millwork plant opened fire on employees before turning the gun on himself this afternoon. The plant employs approximately 60 people, but it is not yet confirmed how many workers were in the building at the time. The incident occurred during a shift change, and authorities say some people were able to escape the building. Goshen is a manufacturing area, and the plant produces simulated wood products. Witnesses say a fight broke out in the building around noon in which the gunman was allegedly involved. They say he left the scene at that time, saying he would return. The names of the gunman and the victims have not yet been released. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Holland in Goshen, Indiana.
The House of Representatives today narrowly approved legislation giving President Bush greater authority to negotiate global trade deals. The bill is the president's top trade priority. It gives him the power to negotiate trade agreements that could be approved or rejected but not changed by Congress. Backers argue it is crucial for American leadership in global trade. Opponents say trade deals undermine workers' rights and the environment. The bill now goes to the Senate. Palestinian riot police have been battling with hundreds of supporters of the Islamic militant group Hamas outside the home of the group's leader. The angry resistance is directed at Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, who's under pressure to end the attacks on Israel. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 15 points. The Nasdaq was up 7. The S&P 500 closed down 3. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual Financial Group, a global diversified financial services organization with more than $220 billion in assets under management, on the web at massmutual.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Afghanistan has proved to be a very dangerous one for journalists. Today we're going to hear from two journalists who recently returned from covering the war. First, we talk with Sebastian Younger. He's the author of two bestsellers, The Perfect Storm and Fire, his new collection of essays, which includes a piece about Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, who was assassinated by suicide bombers 2 days before September 11th. Younger traveled with Massoud and the Northern Alliance in the Panjshir Valley last year. This fall, he returned to Afghanistan to report for ABC News and Vanity Fair. He spent 4 weeks with the Northern Alliance. He was on the front line in the Panjshir Valley and was with the troops as they advanced toward Kabul. He says it was extraordinary when Kabul fell and Northern Alliance troops broke through.
It happened very quickly. The Americans bombed very heavily. Some advance units went forward to occupy bunkers that the Taliban had vacated and retreated from. And then the mass of the Northern Alliance moved forward, just poured through the holes in the front line. And that's what we were part of. And it was part battle, part just wild celebration. We were moving down the highway, a convoy of tanks, Northern Alliance fighters on top of the tanks, on the turrets, everything moving forward at about 30, 40 miles an hour, still fighting up ahead of us. They moved forward so fast that the front part of the column started to catch Taliban stragglers on the highway. They sort of apparently looked at each other in surprise and took a few shots at each other. And then the entry into Kabul was extraordinary because the population was just, as I said, just absolutely jubilant. They were flying kites. They were playing music in the street. They were digging up bags of chess pieces for their chess boards that they'd buried in their backyards because chess was illegal. All these freedoms that you don't think of, they were indulging in as fast as they could.
You traveled with the Northern Alliance last year, and there's an essay about that in your new book, Fire. This time when you were with them, they were being helped by the Americans. There was the American bombing campaign, the whole American war against terrorism. How had that changed their strategy, the way they were fighting?
I'm not sure it changed it that much, except that it gave them the nerve to really go on a wholesale offensive and the confidence that it would work. I watched them. I spent a month with Massoud last year while he was counterattacking after significant Taliban gains that had cut off his supply routes. They were attacking with tremendous bravery, and possibly even confidence, but they weren't getting very far. The Taliban were just too strong. They were doing the same kinds of attacks now, except it was working, and they were facing an enemy that was already demoralized, had already, I think, started to contemplate the idea of failure, of losing, and were planning exit strategies, which is something I think the Taliban had never done before. A lot of the frontline troops that were captured by the Northern Alliance were Pakistanis, were recent volunteers who had just gotten into the country, who'd been in Afghanistan a week maybe, 10 days. And there was some suspicion that the recent recruits, the recent volunteers, were placed on the front line basically to slow down the Northern Alliance advance while the more senior Taliban made their escape, that already a week or two earlier they realized that at some point it was all going to collapse and they wanted to make sure they got out of there.
In your essay in the book Fire about traveling with Ahmed Shah Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, the head until he was assassinated in September, you were very enthusiastic about the Northern Alliance, particularly enthusiastic about Massoud. But lately, we've heard a lot of reports about human rights abuses on the part of various Northern Alliance leaders. And there's a lot of concern that the people from Northern Alliance who end up in positions of power in a post-Taliban government might again turn to the kind of human rights abuses that they were responsible for before the Taliban took over. And that includes everything from checkpoints in which a lot of bribery is necessary to rapes and thievery. And I wonder if you have a different impression at all of the Northern Alliance now than you did a year ago, and if you're more concerned about possible human rights abuses in the future.
Well, of course. I mean, you have to keep in mind it was an incredibly chaotic country that had really just lapsed into a sort of feudal, a very violent feudal state. And there were commanders in the Northern Alliance and on all the sides who did horrendous things. But I think it's important to make the distinction between the individuals and the group. And the Northern Alliance as a whole, their ideals are good. Massoud called for democratic elections, for a multi-ethnic government for years, an offer that frankly was declined by the Taliban. And to some extent, they're trying to stay true to Massoud's vision. It's an awful shame that Massoud's not around to keep the alliance together, because they do have problems of unity. And even in the past few weeks, of course, there have been war crimes committed. There have been Taliban soldiers executed in the trenches by Northern Alliance soldiers. And, of course, that's unfortunate. In any situation, that shouldn't happen. But a lot of journalists actually were surprised at how little that did happen. You could have had a situation where thousands were killed, given how strong the feelings were running after 5 years of fighting each other. The people killed were on the order of several hundred, I think, which is tragic, but of course it could have been worse. And there were even a lot of examples of the Northern Alliance stepping in to save Taliban from lynch mobs in Kabul. The population that had suffered under the Taliban for years really rose up and were trying to lynch some of the Taliban who were left behind in Kabul. And the Northern Alliance stepped in at times to save them. So journalism has to be careful about reporting the glass half empty or half full. I think both of those situations should be reported. And I sort of have to think, as an optimistic human being, that any government is capable of doing good or doing bad. And this particular government has to be encouraged and supported. And hopefully they will follow the right path.
Let's talk a little bit about what this war has been like for journalists. Several journalists have been killed in Afghanistan. What are things that make covering this war particularly risky?
Well, I think the most dangerous thing in this war right now was the fact that it was such a big story. Hundreds and hundreds of journalists poured in there. So you had inexperienced journalists, some of whom had never been in a war before, covering a country that is exceptionally chaotic and sort of freewheeling. I mean, the Northern Alliance fighters were, you know, if you wanted to ride on their tank, you'd just get on their tank and they'd go forward. You know, they were very, you know, their attitude was very much, okay, if you want to get yourself in trouble, feel free. We're not going to stop you. And journalists generally are not used to that kind of freedom. And the journalists who got killed, with one exception, they were doing things that, frankly, I wouldn't have done. They were driving. Four of them were killed on a road between Jalalabad and Kabul in a situation where they thought the Taliban had been defeated. But, of course, it's not black and white, particularly in Afghanistan. Nothing's black and white. There are a lot of Taliban units still roaming around. It's a chaotic country. And they didn't stop to think that that road wasn't secure. And it was a tremendously dangerous thing for them to do, and they're just ambushed. They weren't killed in a frontline battle. They were just ambushed. The journalists killed in Talokan, they were on top of a Northern Alliance tank, and they're going forward at night in a battle zone, I mean, that's a liberty that very, very few armies will grant you. And they basically got themselves in trouble because they were sort of living a journalist's dream. My God, we can go forward with the tanks, and they really shouldn't have been.
But you were on a tank going into Kabul, weren't you?
We were behind the first tanks, and it was in the daytime, and it was a much more, as far as we could tell, it was a much more stable situation. What we heard on the radio, military radios, was that the Taliban lines had completely collapsed, and even so, we were worried about it. And we made a decision that we may have lived or not lived to regret, but it seemed okay. And there are points where you just have to take a risk because it seems so important. What I wouldn't have done was to do that at night. Nighttime is a whole different thing. And there was a point when night fell on the highway to Kabul. There was fighting up ahead, and we decided we wouldn't go any further because it had gotten dark.
So when you decided, because it was dark, that you would just wait where you were while the Northern Alliance men went forward, did you end up alone on the road that night?
No, we actually pulled back. We went back to our base in Bagram. And one thing we were worried about was the entire Northern Alliance army being cut off on the Shamali Plain as they rushed headlong towards Kabul. And it wasn't inconceivable, and that really worried us. They could have cut off 10,000 men there. Massoud had done the exact same thing to the Taliban a few years earlier. They had broken through in that same area, but going northwards, of course, and he pulled back. His men went up into the mountains. He let them come in, and he came down out of the mountains that night and cut them off and killed hundreds of them. The Taliban easily could have done that, and that they didn't shows a real collapse in their command system and, frankly, in their will to fight. It's something that I think militarily could have easily been accomplished, and the Northern Alliance were taking no precautions against it that I could see, and we were all extremely worried about that.
Now, you've reported that there's a lot of journalists in Afghanistan who'd like to get out, but they can't. What are some of the problems journalists are having getting out?
Well, right now I'm not sure because I haven't been there for 10 days. When I was there, the snows had just started to fall in the high mountains, so the passes were closed. Even without the snow, it was a four-day drive, absolutely brutal drive on not even dirt roads, just through the mountains, through streams, through everything. And now that four-day drive was lengthened by the fact that you would have to drive to the bottom of a pass and then cross over on horseback over 14,000-foot passes and then continue on the other side. I mean, a real odyssey. The alternative was to take a helicopter, and these helicopters were run by the Afghan government and were used to ferry ammunition and all kinds of things in and out of northern Afghanistan from Tajikistan, an area where there are very few roads. And the spaces on the helicopter were hard to come by because there were hundreds of journalists and a lot of them needed to get out. So there were actually brawls that broke out on the airstrip between journalists trying to get onto these helicopters. The Afghans were sort of watched this with sort of alarm and amusement. They'd never seen Western journalists brawling before. In fact, one Afghan said to another, this was overheard by a friend of mine, he said, "These are just the journalists. Imagine when their soldiers come here, what they're like." I think, in fact, the soldiers are acting a good deal better than a lot of the journalists did. I think there was 130 people waiting on the list to get out, and these helicopters only took, you know, 8 or 10 people at a time with their gear, and they only flew when the weather was clear, and the clouds would move in for days at a time sometimes. So there was actually a sort of rising panic among the journalists that they could just simply be stuck there all winter. It didn't happen, obviously.
One of the people I think you met on this trip was Massoud's son. Massoud, again, was the leader of the Northern Alliance until he was assassinated in September. What's Massoud's son up to? Where does he live? What are his plans? And what are the rest of the family's plans?
Well, Massoud's son is 13, sort of 13 going on 40. I mean, he had a presence and a dignity that I think I've rarely encountered even in other adults. Just an extraordinary kid. I mean, he was really like he just incorporated his father into him. He's in grade school. And we saw him in Dushanbe in Tajikistan, where he's getting good education, with some political ambitions in Afghanistan. I mean, he clearly was sort of urged by his father, if not instructed by his father, to think of himself as a possible leader for Afghanistan in the future. I mean, you think that the Taliban killed his father, and if you know, this country has been at war for a long time. If you consider those things, and then you'd hear what he said. I was really moved almost to tears. He was saying, you know, peace is the only way. And my father was a great fighter, but he didn't want me to learn anything about the military. He said, my world will be a peaceful world. And I'm studying now because that's the way I can best make use of my life for my country, is by being a learned and fair man. And I won't need to be a fighter. My father promised me that there'll be peace when I'm grown up, and I want to lead our people in a time of peace. And to hear those words coming out of a 13-year-old was really, I think, one of the most extraordinary interviews I've ever done as a journalist.
Well, Sebastian Younger, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sebastian Younger reported from Afghanistan for ABC News and Vanity Fair. His new book is called Fire. Coming up, Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe describes what he witnessed in Afghanistan. This is Fresh Air. My guest Charles Sennett has been covering the war in Afghanistan for the Boston Globe. He returned 1 week ago from his second trip to Afghanistan since the war began. Sennett is the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East correspondent. He's also author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, about the diminishing Christian population in the Middle East. During the first part of this trip, he was in Uzbekistan with the American military. Then he crossed the border into Afghanistan and got to Mazar-i-Sharif in time to witness the uprising of about 500 Taliban prisoners who had earlier surrendered to the Northern Alliance. Most of these prisoners were Arabs, Pakistanis, and Chechens who had fought with the Taliban. The rebellion lasted 3 days and was put down by the Northern Alliance and U.S. forces.
We got there literally within an hour of when this revolt started. The kind of general description of that whole scenario that I would create was that it was a fiasco, that the first American casualty, which was this CIA official who was killed inside the prison revolt, should not have died. This was just incredible ineptitude and carelessness and chaos on the part of the Northern Alliance not to have searched the prisoners. And as an American journalist there, I really felt like things were out of control with these defections and with taking the prisoners and with the extraordinary trust that the Northern Alliance officials put in the word of the Taliban that they've actually defected. I think it's a cultural thing in Afghanistan that a lot of us who are Western reporters had a great difficulty understanding. And I was wondering, where was the voice of our government in questioning these deals and in trying to be a little bit more forceful in terms of processing prisoners, in terms of really assessing these defections rather than just trusting them?
You say that the prisoners hadn't been searched. I think there was a grenade that one of them had that started off the whole rebellion.
That's right. The grenade was hidden somewhere on one of these prisoners. And that maybe could happen once. And you could see that. But what's really outrageous about this is it had happened the day before the revolt. On Saturday, there was a prisoner who exploded a grenade, injured an ITN reporter, and killed three Northern Alliance soldiers in the same fortress compound. And that should have been a signal to them that these guys have hidden grenades, you know, in their tunics or wherever, somewhere on their body. And what happened was the next day, the same sequence began, that once again a prisoner who had secreted one of these grenades in somehow threw the grenade and this time managed to kill, it's estimated, about 10 Northern Alliance guards who were watching over these 500 prisoners in the first line at least. And then the prisoners seized the weapons, including the weapon of the CIA official who was there assessing the conditions of the prison and also looking to find out if any of these prisoners could offer real-time information on the whereabouts of bin Laden or senior al-Qaeda forces members. So you had a situation in which, I think, tremendous carelessness, sloppiness just exploded, and these 500 prisoners quickly seized the opportunity with the chaos created by the grenade, grabbed the weapons and of their guards, and then quickly killed 30 more Northern Alliance soldiers and then had their weapons. And of course, these inmates, these people who had defected, were in control of this fortress before the Northern Alliance took over Mazar Sharif, so they knew the lay of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically made a run for the weapons depot. And when they seized the weapons depot, they had all of the ammunition they needed, and that's why it was a three-day horrific, bloody battle that we watched unfold right before our eyes.
Now, when you say it's a cultural thing that the Northern Alliance didn't search the Taliban who had surrendered, what do you mean by that?
There's a saying in Afghanistan that precedes this war that really goes back very far in the history of Afghanistan, and that's that no one ever loses a war, they just switch sides. And this notion of shifting alliances and how rapidly they happen is something that those who know more about Afghanistan than I do have told me to watch for, that what you have is a very practical country that revolves around trade. And basically, whoever has the power will control the trade. And the warlords that are going to emerge victorious are the ones you need to get along with if you're going to basically be able to conduct trade the way you want to. So the economy and warfare merge at some point in a very practical reality in which they determine who's the victor before there's a lot of killing. And they switch sides. And I'm personally very surprised at this. I mean, these were people who said they would fight to the death. And suddenly they're just flipping sides immediately. It's this, the fickleness of it, I don't trust. And I worry a lot about surprise counterattacks from prisoners who said they had defected. And I wonder if the fortress isn't the first example of that.
Charles Sennett returned from Afghanistan 1 week ago. He's the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and author of the new book, The Body and the Blood. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, watching the special forces at work, we continue our conversation with Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. He just returned from Afghanistan. And we'll get his perspective on the escalating violence in the Middle East. Sennett is the Globe's former Middle East bureau chief.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. He returned 1 week ago from his second trip to Afghanistan since the war began. He's the Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East bureau chief. He's also the author of the new book, The Body and the Blood, about the diminishing Christian population in the Middle East. When we left off, we were talking about the uprising in Mazar-e-Sharif, where there was a revolt of Taliban soldiers who were being held prisoner after surrendering to the Northern Alliance. You were at Mazar-e-Sharif when the Taliban soldiers who surrendered started an uprising. And you say you got to see the special forces at work when they came in to help the Northern Alliance put down that uprising. What are some of the things you saw the special forces do?
One thing we saw them do is arrive at the scene, which was kind of startling because there were about 30 journalists, including myself, who were kind of camped out along the perimeter of this fortress. I would say we were approximately 130 yards back from the entrance to the fortress. And the fortress stands as this enormous mud brick structure that looks like something from another century. And all of it is so disconcerting to see this kind of World War I fighting going on with artillery shells and mortar and the mortars landing and bursts of dirt kind of erupting, you know, about 50 yards in front of you. And just a very chaotic scene that didn't seem out of this war, out of a war in which you think of the kind of high-tech weaponry that the U.S. forces would bring to bear. And when they arrived, you know, our men kind of in their desert camouflage came in this kind of beat-up, funky old little taxi minivan with not quite fuzzy dice, but the local equivalent to that, you know, like little dangly ornaments and things. And they obviously had just driven through Mazar-e-Sharif, where, of course, there are Taliban and Northern Alliance now just out on the street, the Taliban having, quote, surrendered, and the Northern Alliance having, you know, quote, taken over. So in Mazar-e-Sharif, there's very much a confusing picture of who's who and who you can trust. When they arrived, they just stumbled out of this van, and there were probably 12 of them, and they hugged some of the Northern Alliance commanders, and one of them was able to speak a little bit of broken Dari. And just to see that these guys knew their Northern Alliance commanders, that there's this kind of hand-in-glove approach, I don't know, it's something we shouldn't be surprised by because we've been reading about it, but there was still something about seeing it on the ground and seeing them work together that offered a pretty rare glimpse of the special forces at work. They were strapped down with machine guns and with a lot of, you know, grenades and ammunition belts strapped around their waist. And they were large American guys who didn't want the media in their way and made that very clear to us and told us in no uncertain terms to back off. When they went up into the fortress from there, I didn't see them because I did not go up inside the fortress, as did two cameramen. And I think at great risk to their lives, as it turned out, because an errant U.S. missile struck very close by and injured one of the cameramen. We had to stay back and basically piece together what they were doing from reports of the Northern Alliance commanders with whom they were working. And our sense there was that they were coordinating the assault on these guys. They were calling in the airstrikes.
Who was the Northern Alliance or the Special Forces?
Sorry, the Special Forces were calling in airstrikes and coordinating the assault on this prison revolt and trying to basically bring it under control.
So what kind of strikes did you see? What kind of tactics did you see the Special Forces use?
Well, we basically saw them trying to bring order to the Northern Alliance chaos. And I think that is a very reflective reality of what has been their role throughout this whole campaign. And in that sense, we saw them talking a lot to Northern Alliance guys and very clearly using them as a proxy force. So we kind of got to really see that physical expression of this relationship that we've heard about so much. We also saw them calling in airstrikes, you know, putting down a laser marker. They can point with a laser and pinpoint exactly where they want to put these guided missiles or smart bombs. And, you know, you're always very impressed with this kind of high-tech weaponry. But we also saw, you know, one of the great flaws here, which is that they tried to lay down a marker for a smart bomb, and it missed completely, and it ended up blowing out the wall of this ancient fortress right near where the American Special Forces were with the Northern Alliance. It destroyed this very heavy mud brick wall and seriously injured three Special Forces and lightly injured two. So a total of five American injuries from friendly fire and some more serious injuries for Northern Alliance officials. And as I say, at least one of the cameramen received shrapnel wounds during that whole combination of events as well. But in this occasion, it was very clear that this was an errant bomb, that this was a JDAM smart bomb, in quotes, and it missed its target. And what's interesting is we've now heard that again yesterday there was another JDAM that went astray and also has apparently killed three American soldiers. These are the reports in the papers today. So what interests me in this is that we have four known American casualties in this war, and all four of them are friendly fire.
Where were you while the attack was going on?
It's a three-day ordeal, right? It's kind of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I was there for much of the attack just outside the entrance. We would leave at night, so we would get there early in the morning, kind of watch events unfold and pull back at night because it's really dangerous out there, especially at night. But from where we were staying in Mazar Sharif, we could watch the U.S. airstrikes pounding this fortress. And there was one night in particular, the night where they just got fed up with the resistance that the prisoners were putting up, that we counted and the Northern Alliance officials counted 40 U.S. missile strikes directly into the prison, which is just, it's unbelievable that anyone survived that. I'm still amazed that some of these fighters who did this prison revolt lived through that night. And when we came back the next morning, and that was now Wednesday morning, I believe my timing is right on that, the morning after these very heavy missile strikes, the first thing I heard was just a soft crackle of gunfire coming from the prisoner's side. And you thought, my God, how did these guys live through that night? So that was how we covered it. And there was a sense that these fighters were not going to stop, that they really were going to try to fight to the death. I think some of the criticism I've heard of this situation, that this was a slaughter, from my perception of being there on the ground, seems unfair. I think they were not going to stop fighting until they were dead. And therefore, the Northern Alliance and U.S. Special Forces were doing what they felt they had to do to quell this.
My guest is Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Charles Sennett, is the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East correspondent. He returned 1 week ago from his second trip to Afghanistan since the war began. You were with the Northern Alliance in late September, early October. Was your impression of the Northern Alliance any different this trip than it was in the previous one?
I think they're more anxious to reap the gains that they feel they are justly owed as a result of winning this war. When I was with them early on, they were frustrated with the American forces, that they weren't moving quickly enough. And if you remember, they kept telling us, just if you just hit those front lines for 2 days, we can make this happen. And I began to be very suspicious of that. I thought they were too undisciplined and the whole scene was too chaotic and that the Taliban were more deeply entrenched than we realized. And of course, based on events, we were proven completely wrong. And in fact, they were right. It took about 2 days after the United States started to really hit the front lines hard for these cities to begin to topple like dominoes. So I think they are very smug these days, and they feel very justified that they told America so. And I had a feeling in Mazar Sharif, being with Dastum's forces especially, this is General Abdul Rashid Dastum, who is the Uzbek warlord, kind of a legendary warlord. I have the feeling that he has the potential to really mess things up, that he is after returning to his role as the leader of this fiefdom, that he sees that Mazar Sharif is a critical trade route, you know, this ancient Silk Road city where all of the natural resources are going to have to flow through this country, where trade is bustling and necessary, really, for the whole country. It is the critical trade route in. And I think he wants it, and he wants to control it. And I think that he will not give it up without a fight, and we're already seeing signs of that today.
In the meantime, the people meeting in Bonn to help form an interim government, a post-Taliban interim government, appointed Hamid Karzai to lead the new interim government, and this will begin December 22nd, and this interim government will rule for about 6 months, it's projected. Do you know anything about Hamid Karzai, and did you ever meet him?
I have not met him, and what I know about him is what I've been able to read about him, which is that he's a former foreign minister in an earlier government, that he speaks perfect English, and that he is kind of a computer model of exactly what America would want. But I've also heard people who are very smart observers of this whole political situation unfolding in Bonn who worry that the Americans may have put up the person who's perfect for them, you know, a royalist, an English speaker, a kind of nice, clean image for the new leadership, but not someone who can resonate in this very tribal society and in this very, in a society that is really dominated by warlords and in which those with military might are the most respected. And what I was referring to with General Dastum is his statement today that he will not be in agreement with this government, that he will resist it because he feels that the Uzbek population is underrepresented. In other words, he's not getting his share of Mazar Sharif. And I think Dastum is the one to watch, I think, in terms of how will this government come together. It's going to have to be a very delicate balance of a new government, one that will respect human rights, for one thing, one that will try to shake the past of these old warlords who have so tarnished the image of the Northern Alliance, and at the same time have to represent that they also wield power on a very local level. And how this equation comes together is going to be very interesting to watch in the next 6 months.
When you were ready to leave Afghanistan, was it hard to get out?
It is so hard to get out of that place. And I had personal reasons why I had to be home. And so I was on a mission to escape from Afghanistan. And basically, I think one of the most amazing things that I was able to personally accomplish in covering this entire war was getting a barge sent to the Afghan port of Khartoum from the Uzbek government in Tirmez. And to get through that Soviet bureaucracy through payoffs and bribes and bluffs and just incredible kind of American, arrogance, to be honest, to say, you know, this has to be done right now, was really, for me, a thrilling moment. And it also was important because we were starting to get quite concerned as journalists covering that our safety was certainly not guaranteed and probably... it was a more blurred situation security-wise than any time that I had been in there before.
Why?
Well, because you don't know who's who.
Uh-huh.
So getting out of Afghanistan became really a security concern and something that we had to pull off and we had to do quickly. And I think those of us who did get out were thankful because, it was the next day when the four journalists were killed. And I'm very worried about my colleagues over there, and I just hope everyone will think security, because if you look at the numbers, there are twice as many journalists killed as there are American military.
My guest is Charles Sennett. He's the London correspondent for the Boston Globe, former Middle East correspondent, and author of the book The Body and the Blood about Christians in the Holy Land. Charles Sennett, I'd like to talk with you about the latest developments in the Middle East. Ever since last weekend, things have been in total upheaval. Suicide bombings, Israeli counterattacks against Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority. How do you think the equation has changed in the Middle East since last weekend?
Well, I think the game is over for Yasser Arafat. I think that Arafat has postponed, delayed, and played games for a very long time. And I think that he has dangerously opened the window for the Islamic militants, both Hamas and Islamic Jihad, to completely derail his efforts to try to get back to the negotiations. On the other hand, I think that Ariel Sharon has shown that he has no plan at all, that Ariel Sharon is pushing ahead with a policy that I don't understand. I mean, if he is intent on destroying the Palestinian Authority and possibly even trying to kill Yasser Arafat, where does that take us? And I think on the political level, it's completely impractical, because what he does is he creates a power vacuum in which Islamic Jihad and Hamas will very quickly rush in. I think he also undercuts the whole Palestinian people's idea of who is their leader, Yasser Arafat, and therefore inherits all of the problems of Yasser Arafat. I mean, I think he would be smarter to be more targeted in his approach to the source of the problem, which is Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And I think it's a very flawed strategy, even from a practical level, in which if you smash Arafat's helicopter, that's kind of an emotional response to what's happened, these horrible suicide bombings, and perfectly understandable on a human level, but ridiculous on a practical political level, because you've now inhibited Arafat's ability to actually do the work that needs to be done. He can't physically accomplish the security goals that the whole world is yelling at him to accomplish right now if you continue to dismantle all of his security structure, all of his buildings, his helicopters. So I really wonder where Sharon is headed with this policy. It seems like blind revenge. It seems like a miscalculation to me.
Are you saying that Sharon has also undermined Arafat's authority, making it more difficult for him to take control?
Exactly. I think that Sharon wants to dismantle the Palestinian Authority. And I think this has been fairly clear since he came to power that this has been one of his goals in terms of crushing the Intifada by slowly dismantling the Palestinian Authority. And as I say, I really question this. I don't see this as an intelligent way forward. And I wonder, where is the labor part of this coalition government in voicing this? It's a very hard time to do that because of the powerful emotion of the suffering on the streets of Jerusalem at the hands of suicide bombers. But it's also a time to get those voices out there, because I think we're really at a critical turning point, and I think this thing could really now descend into chaos and war on a level that we haven't seen before.
My guest is Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest, Charles Sennett, is the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Middle East bureau chief. His new book, The Body and the Blood, is about the diminishing Christian population in the Middle East. There's an article in the New York Times today saying that Hamas may be more representational of the Palestinian mainstream than Arafat's group Fatah is. Fatah really is undermined, and Hamas or Islamic Jihad takes over in the power vacuum, is it possible that Israel could actually negotiate with Hamas, negotiate some kind of peace with Hamas? Or do you see that as being really a remote possibility?
I see that as a very remote possibility. The point of view of Hamas is not the point of view at which the Oslo peace process begins. Oslo begins at the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's recognition of the State of Israel's right to exist in the pre-1967 boundaries. That is the whole core that Israel and the Palestinians will live up to the UN Resolution 242, which means that those areas that Israel occupied after June 1967 will be turned over to the Palestinian Authority for their control, where they will build a state. Hamas does not accept that basic laying of the land of Oslo, and therefore we would be starting from scratch. I think that there may be an attempt on the part of the Israelis to reach out and seize Hamas and Islamic Jihad to completely divide the Palestinian population and to therefore fracture all of its goals, blur the picture completely, and therefore start down a new path in which Israel will dictate on a very local level who will control what. And I think it'll be very sad if the Palestinians fall for that. I doubt they will. I don't think Hamas and Islamic Jihad are reflective of the majority of the Palestinians. I think they're a very small percentage. For one thing, Palestinians are pretty secular. You know, they know the Western culture. They are great readers of books, and, you know, they like to have their lives. And they've watched the Islamic fundamentalist movements all throughout the Middle East and the way they've crushed cultural expression. And I think Palestinians are very proud of their culture and want to express that. So I don't see them as agreeing with this, but I do see the possibility of some people on the far right in Israel trying to play a game of divide and rule. And we have to remember that Sharon is the architect of the settlements. Sharon's whole life has been dedicated to a policy of expanding the settlements into the West Bank. He feels very strongly that these settlements are critical in terms of where Israel's population will live, how it will define its security, and its access, critically, to water resources in the West Bank. He is not going to give them up. I don't think he would ever give them up under any kind of peace agreement. And I think what's really sad to watch is Arafat allow the situation to disintegrate to the point where now he's basically handed the fate of the Palestinians over to Ariel Sharon.
Arafat and the Palestinian Authority has put the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas under house arrest. What do you think is the significance of that?
Well, I think, first of all, that Arafat has to do this. I think that, you know, Hamas has claimed responsibility for the worst spree of suicide bombing that we've had ever in Israel. So I think that he has to do it. I think it's also going to cause him a lot of problems. I think that the game is finally up. You know, Arafat let this get out of control, and now Hamas and Islamic Jihad have kind of had this surge in violence, and he's going to have to control it, and he's going to look as if he is bowing to Israeli and American pressure. And in many ways, he is, and that's his problem. He should have done it earlier. But if they think, if the Palestinian Authority thinks that they can surround the house of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, this crippled man who is in a wheelchair, who is this really beloved leader of the First Intifada and the founder of Hamas, I think they're kidding themselves. I think they are setting themselves up. I mean, the way in which they're going to have to bring this crippled man
right
out of that house is dramatic. Or if they're going to leave him in the house, the symbol they'll create around his very desperately poor neighborhood in Gaza is very important and I think very dangerous for the Palestinian Authority if they become an occupying force of Hamas. I mean, I think if they feel they have the goods on Sheikh Yassin, the leader of Hamas, then they should arrest him. House arrest, I think, is a potentially dangerous scenario.
What do you think is the best hope for the future in the Middle East?
I think we have to think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict post-Arafat, post-Sharon. I think these two men represent all of the old ossified ideologies and the hard points that they both reflect within their societies. And I think we came so close to breaking through this, you know, with Camp David in July 2000. And now I really think we're back to a generation away. And I think that it's going to require an education on the part of young people. I mean, this is very cliche. People say this all the time, but I think it's the truth. As soon as you have Israeli kids in Tel Aviv studying Arabic and eagerly learning to communicate with the other side and recognizing that Israel exists in the Arab world. I mean, Israel is in the Middle East. It's not in Europe. You know, they have to stop having kind of Europop contests in Tel Aviv. They have to stop playing European soccer. And they have to think about becoming integrated into the Middle East, even if that means forcing their way in, even if that means culturally coming up with a lot of money to create these connections. I think it's very important to do, and I don't think it's naive to say it can be done. I think it can, and I think that'll be the beginning. And the same goes for the Palestinian side. They are going to have to really work on their schools, which preach incitement, which come at a very hard line that does not recognize the right of Israel to exist. And they're going to have to understand that Israel is not going away. And they're going to have to build a generation that wants to work with Israel, not work against it. And I think when those two things happen, we'll see change. Until then, we're going to be dealing with a leadership that is just living in the past and that is dragging both sides back into that past over and over again with one cycle after another of revenge and recrimination and hatred.
Charles Sennett, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Sennett is the Boston Globe's London Bureau Chief and former Middle East Bureau Chief. His new book, The Body and the Blood, is about the diminishing Christian population in the Middle East. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Honorable Company, a novel of India before the Raj by Alan Mallison. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new movie Ocean's 11 is an updated version of the 1960 film that was a vehicle for the Rat Pack. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the author of Rat Pack Confidential and from the editors of a book of Sinatra's FBI files. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.